Welcome to the Making Sense Podcast. This is Sam Harris. Today I'm speaking with Ben Lamb. Ben is a technology and software entrepreneur who has been featured in many publications, the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Forbes, discussing topics related to innovation and technology. He is also the co-founder and CEO of Colossal Biosciences, a company he started with biologist George Church for the purpose of resurrecting extinct species like the woolly mammoth and the Tasmanian tiger and the dodo, and they aim to reintroduce them into the wild. Ben is also a fellow of the Explorers Club and serves on the Scientific Advisory Board of the Planetary Society. But we focus on his work at Colossal. We discuss the difference between their approach and Jurassic Park, the details of resurrecting the mammoth and other species, the relevance of this work to human health, the role of artificial intelligence here, what it would take to reintroduce mammoths and Tasmanian tigers and dodos back into the wild, the environmental and business case for doing this, and other topics. Anyway, the future appears to be almost here. And now I bring you Ben Lamb. I am here with Ben Lamb. Ben, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we're going to talk about some amazing stuff that you're doing over there at Colossal, your biotech company. But before we get there, how do you summarize your career and interests at this point? Or how did you give me the potted bio that gets us to the topic at hand?
Well, I'm definitely insatiably curious. And so I'm always, I'm not really a technologist. I'm not really an engineer. I try to look at things from a systems design perspective. And I'm always fascinated with how things work and how things can be improved. And I always like to find new, interesting projects. And so I've been in everything from mobile gaming before that was quite big. I built some precursors to large language models that we were actually calling conversational operating systems at the time. My last company was actually satellite software and defense. So we actually built a common operating picture to understand and track everything in the sky all the way, actually in low Earth orbit, all the way down to the surface of the sea, and worked closely with the US Air Force and Space Force and some of our global partners on that. And then I met George Church, and I actually kind of fell into de-extinction. I reached out to him because I'm curious, and I thought that the intersection of synthetic biology and AI and computational biology and quantum, which I hear is only 2 years away every 2 years, will eventually kind of give us dominion to engineer life and do directed evolution on a scale that is unprecedented for human advancement. And so I got massively excited about the opportunities there. And then I asked George the question, and I said, if you had one project with unlimited capital that you could focus on for the rest of your life, what would it be, George? And, didn't know what I would get out of George. Is it going to, another star system or what? And his feedback was I would bring back woolly mammoths and help reintroduce them back into the ecosystem to help biodiversity in the ecosystem, as well as develop technologies for both human healthcare and species preservation. And at that moment, I was pretty hooked.
Yeah. George is a very impressive scientist. I've met him, I think it might have only been once, maybe twice at a conference, but is he still at Harvard?
He's still at Harvard. Yeah. So I do get to monopolize a decent amount of his time, but we do share him with Harvard and a handful of other initiatives he's co-founded.
So the company is Colossal Biosciences. Is that the full name?
Correct.
And so what are you doing over there at Colossal?
Yeah, so we decided that we wanted to build the world's first de-extinction and species preservation company. Because if you look at some of these stats and kind of the trend line that we're seeing for biodiversity loss and what the impacts to ecosystems will be, especially from a keystone perspective, it's pretty terrifying. And when we started the company, our original pitch deck, all the data we could find showed that if without massive human intervention or massive new technologies, that we could lose up to 15% of biodiversity between now and 2050. What's terrifying is in 2024, that number has been upped to 50%, 50. So that's not a very good trend line. And so George had this vision, and I just feel like I'm kind of the steward and helper with it, of we could go build a company that could, one, build tools and technologies that could be capable of bringing back lost species, as well as applying those technologies and innovation to conservation, giving that to the world for free. And all these species have direct applications, those technologies like genetic engineering and others, to human healthcare. So we really had this interesting opportunity to build a company that hopefully could inspire people, create true impact, but also create massive value creation around the way.
And which species are you focused on first?
So we've announced three species to date, the woolly mammoth, which George was actually working on for about 8 years before I showed up, collecting samples in Siberia, working on computational analysis in elephants, the Tasmanian tiger, also known as the thylacine, which went extinct in 1936 in Tasmania and Lower Australia due to human hunting. The Australian government actually put a bounty on eradicating the species. And then, you know, we wanted a bird species. We wanted to recruit Beth Shapiro, who's our chief science officer. So we did the dodo, because there's probably not a more iconic species than the dodo that symbolizes de-extinction.
So how is this different from Jurassic Park? I mean, that, you know, I don't think anyone would really associate it with Jurassic Park until you bring in the mammoth. And then all of a sudden, we're talking about charismatic megafauna, and we're hoping for a T-Rex. To what degree does that vision account for some of your enthusiasm around this? And I mean, obviously, there's a difference between reintroducing animals to the wild and setting up a theme park. Are you? I mean, was Jurassic Park a formative idea for you, or is that, or are you arrived where you are by a different path?
So we get the Jurassic Park question quite a bit, as that may not surprise you.
Yeah.
Like occasionally when I go on stage to speak, they'll play the music. You know, we've seen every meme with like George's face on it or my face on it. So we've heard this a time or two. George will tell you, so I think George and I have slightly different perspectives on it. George will tell you that in a weird way, he thinks that Michael Crichton was actually inspired, and Jurassic Park was actually inspired by him. Because if you go look in the original Jurassic Park novel, there's actually a DNA sequence early in the work, in the novel. And it actually is George's work with only one letter changed. Mm-hmm. And George will argue that statistically,
it's still plagiarism.
It's still, and George loves, you know, many of Crichton's novels, right? And it's a very inspiring author that he was. And, but George will tell you that, you know, he laughs and says, maybe I inspired Jurassic Park, because a lot of his original work in yeast is actually shows up in the book. I will tell you from my perspective, you know, growing up, you know, born in the 80s, you know, a child of the 80s and 90s, you know, I think one, you know, I love science fiction. I love Jurassic Park. That's not necessarily why I got into this, but it sure makes it a lot easier to connect with people. Because even though we have the memes and all the jokes that come around Colossal versus Jurassic Park, at least, you know, Jurassic Park, which was this dystopian movie, at least it taught people about there's this thing called DNA. And there's this thing called genetic engineering. And so like moms in Iowa know that there's this ability to manipulate the genome because of Mr. DNA, right? And so we a lot of times use Jurassic Park as an example of how we're doing it exactly inverse, meaning that we're not trying to fill the gaps in a ancient DNA that with the holes that you get from, you know, frogs or whatnot. We're trying to truly understand the genomes so that we could selectively choose the genes that we then want to engineer into that of a living species. So it's almost like reverse Jurassic Park. And when we say that to the kind of average public, and that we're in some journalists and whatnot, when we're explaining the process and the science, they really resonate with it. Because I think that movie does have such a, had was the right movie with the right technology and the right story at the right time that really connects with people.
So let's go over those details again. So what was being proposed as the scientific, you know, bioengineering basis for Jurassic Park, and what exactly are you doing with, you know, paleogenomics and going out into the wild and getting DNA samples, however imperfectly preserved, and integrating them with living species? What is your approach, and how is it different from what was being? It's been a long time since I saw the film. I actually never read the novel, so I don't know if the films depart from the novel in their logic. And I know nothing about any of the you know, errors that Crichton might have made in with respect to his molecular biology, if he made any. So what was proposed there, and what are you guys actually doing?
So in Jurassic Park, they proposed that you could go find pieces of like amber, which by the way is a very porous material. It is not a good DNA store. Not that we've tried. But then magically in amber, you'd get insects and specifically mosquitoes that had been trapped for over 65 million years. And while that's true, there isn't DNA from that. Amber, as I mentioned, is a very porous material. It is not, it's not a great DNA store. Typically, the best DNA stores for us for ancient DNA are cold, dry places. So animals that passed away in a cave, in a very dry cave that stayed consistent without other animals in it, that's kind of optimal for us. And so then they would take this DNA that they extracted from a mosquito that lived, you know, 100 million years ago and bit a dinosaur, and they would extract in the movie actual blood, which also is impossible. And then they would take that blood, use computers, which is very similar to what we do, which I'll get into, and then fill in the holes of the ancient DNA, because ancient DNA is very, very fragmented, with that of, in the movie, frog DNA, and amongst some other, many other things. But the problem with that, number one, is there isn't ancient dino DNA. You know, the oldest DNA that we were able to collect is, you know, a little bit over a million years. There's some fragments and stuff that are older, but, you know, for the most part, we're working in thousands and tens of thousands of years, not, you know, millions of years, because DNA degrades very, very quickly. It starts to break down the minute it leaves your body. And so when you layer in like radiation, heat, acidification, other animals' defecation, other animals dying on it, it starts to break down, and it also gets massively contaminated. It's not truly endogenous at that point, right? And so what we do is, instead of going and taking a bunch of different pieces of a mammoth, assembling it and saying, what's missing, and how do we plug that with a frog or elephant DNA, we do it almost exactly in reverse. So the first thing that we did is we went out and we looked at phylogenetically, so on that tree of life that we've all seen some version of it, you know, in science textbooks and today on the internet, we say, what is the closest living relative to the mammoth in this case? And that's actually the Asian elephant. It's 99.6% the same genetically. It's actually closer genetically to an Asian elephant than an Asian elephant is to an African elephant. And that's kind of a fun party trivia for you. And then we spent a lot of time trying to do comparative genomics, truly use a bunch of software, use AI, some of our custom models to understand what is the difference even from an African elephant to an Asian elephant? What is the difference from a population level? So we actually sequence a lot of different Asian elephants. So what is truly Asian elephant versus population diversity in those genomes? Because not all genomes are obviously exact copies of each other. And then how do we compare that to the mammoth? And then we can identify, okay, where are these regions of the genome that are vastly different? And what do we know about that from scientific research, from other peer-reviewed papers, you know, from actually doing molecular and functional assays, actually growing stem cells and testing our hypothesis? So you have to do a lot of work to then kind of verify what we think the core genes that made a mammoth were, so that then we can engineer them into that of an Asian elephant cell. And that's not just taking pieces and pushing it in there. That's actually just changing existing code. So we fundamentally don't need long-term pieces of these DNA. We don't need all these dead samples. We just need the code in the computer.
So do we have the complete genome of the woolly mammoth? I mean, is that something that's disputed, or did we get enough samples of sufficient integrity such that we just know we've got the full mammoth genome?
We have enough. So we have about 65 mammoth genomes. Most of those aren't published. Most of those are Siberian and Russian mammoth samples. We're now doing a lot of work with Alaskan mammoths as well. And we work with about 17 universities across the world, one of which is the University of Stockholm, and Luva Dahlin's work. And Luva is arguably the number one mammoth researcher in the world. And so we've taken all of his different samples, and it's about a 700,000-year difference between all the different samples to kind of fill that in. Wow. But we have enough of the protein coding regions of it, as well as Colombian mammoths, steppe mammoths, and others. And we have a pretty cool paper that I hope will come out mid-next year about this that shows the comparative genomics that we know enough of the mammoth genome that we can identify the core areas around cold tolerance, fat, hair, curved tusk. So we actually have enough to do our work. It is not as complete as our thylacine genome, which we recently announced is 99.5% complete, or no, sorry, 99.9% complete, which is truly incredible for any genome, let alone ancient DNA.
That's the Tasmanian tiger?
Correct.
So Are you using CRISPR technology to insert mammoth code into an Asian elephant zygote, or what is the step there that would produce a living mammoth?
Yeah, so we start with an Asian elephant cell, right? And we actually had to spend a lot of time getting the culture conditions right, actually immortalizing those cells. One of the things that, you know, before we get into the genetic engineering side, one of the things that's interesting about elephants and blue whales and a handful of other species is they actually get cancer a fraction of what we do based on age and body weight of which they grow to. And the leading theory of that, and we're seeing this also being verified in our lab, is they have an overexpression of a protein called P53, about seven times more than we have in mice have, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And what's interesting is we've actually had to learn how to regulate that, because anytime we went to go make those changes, which we'll get into, the cell would just senesce. So not only do we have to build immortalization constructs to keep the cells growing and living and healthy, we also had to figure out how we can, quote unquote, turn down P53 so that we could edit the cells and then be able to turn it back up, because you don't want to produce, you know, cancer in elephants, right? Mm. And so there's a lot of prep work before we even get to the point that we can do the engineering itself. And as you can probably guess, you know, because your deep background in science, you know, CRISPR has become a catch-all for all genetic engineering. They're like, oh, it's just CRISPR, right? We just CRISPR it. But what's interesting is we use a combination of tools, some of which are proprietary, some of which have been invented by other organizations and universities, and then we layer new techniques on it. So in some cases, we're changing the individual nucleotides, the individual letters on that double helix. In other cases, we're knocking out certain genes. And in other cases, we're actually synthesizing big blocks of DNA, where if there's like a bunch of changes along one kind of strand, it's actually more efficient for us to synthesize that block, knock that block out, and then insert this new block so that you have less likelihoods of off-target effects or unintended consequences from your editing. And I'd say the last thing that we're doing that on the editing front that is our kind of, I think the thing that sets us apart from a genomics perspective is we're trying to become the biggest pioneer of multiplex editing, meaning editing all over the genome at the same time. So instead of making one edit, maybe you can make 20 edits, 50 edits, 1,000 edits, all with a very high degree of efficiency versus having to synthesize entire giant blocks. I do believe that technology will get here, being able to synthesize even full chromosomes at some point, but we as humanity aren't quite there yet. So editing is the most efficient kind of current modality that we've been pursuing.
So at what point did this actually become technically feasible? I mean, what year would you say this became something that you could actually start on and it ceased to be just a piece of science fiction?
Yeah. So I think, you know, people have been talking about, you know, CRISPR, you know, in some version of genetic engineering from the 80s, right? But it was, I don't remember the exact year, but it was like, what, 2012, 15, 14, somewhere around there, where we had the true kind of discovery around, you know, CRISPR and the idea that you could, you know, target a part of the genome, successfully knock it out and have it repair itself. And I think from there, you've seen work like David Liu's work in prime and base editing, where you can change individual letters. You've seen kind of this like pre-Cambrian explosion, you know, to use our Jurassic, you know, some of our Jurassic fun terms, of genetic engineering tools and technologies, because we've all been promised from the 80s and 90s gene therapies and genetic engineering capabilities that would allow us to do all kinds of stuff, right? That have never really manifested. But I think that really in the last, you know, 10 years has been where those technologies have been viable. I don't believe before that kind of 2012, 2015 timeframe of like that CRISPR race with, you know, Fang and
Jennifer Doudna.
And Doudna and all of them, right? That are just there, and George included, which were all incredible scientists. I don't believe that this would have been a viable undertaking. And now after that, it became viable, but it, you know, you still have compute, you still have AI. There's a lot of other components to it, and it just becomes very, very costly. The goal to really make this where it's possible and scalable, I think we're still a little bit early, but we're in kind of the right kind of 5 years to truly be able to deliver.
So is AI a necessary component of the process?
It is. And, you know, we're learning every day new ways that we can apply. You know, my background has been mostly in software, right? And so, you know, we're finding every day new ways to apply these technologies around it. Like, we actually have a tool that we built internally that we've been giving it this feedback loop. So we built a cool little model that probably doesn't apply to most people, but for us, we find it fascinating, that will actually give us the right recommendation that's over 90% accurate of what tool we should use for the specific edit that we're going after. And that's awesome when you think about biology, because if you're going to make an edit, you then have to go see if that edit worked. You then have to grow those cells. Those cells have to live. Then you have to sequence those cells. You got to wait a couple weeks in some cases if you don't have sequencing cores internally to get that data back. And so the feedback loop, if you've made the wrong edit using the wrong tool, or at least the most efficient tool, you know, can be months of lost scientific experiment time, both costly in terms of go to market and in terms of your research and all the reagents and stuff that you had to go use in that, right? And so we're now using AI not just for comparative genomics, but even in selection of what editing tool we should use for the editing job that we're trying to go pursue.
So now, how far have you gotten? And now I'm not asking just about the mammoth, but you can talk about the dodo or the Tasmanian tiger or anything else you've experimented with. What have you produced in the lab, and is it all still in vitro, or what? Do you have a pregnant Asian elephant that has a name?
There's no secret pregnant Asian elephant mammoth, unfortunately. Okay. I would be the first to, I couldn't be more excited to share with you, yeah, if there was. So de-extinction is a systems problem, right? There's computational analysis work, there's ancient DNA work. So there's field work, as you mentioned. Some of that's been done by other researchers. Some of that's in the catacombs of museums. Some of that's actually out in the field. So there's all of that. Then there's the computational side. There's the cellular engineering side, optimizing that. There's the genetic engineering side. Then there's the animal husbandry side, right? Of how do we grow these animals ex utero, in vitro, but grow it in surrogates. And then there's an ex utero component. So we actually have a 17-person team that's working on artificial wombs, which we can also talk about at some point if interesting. None of our first generation species will be grown in artificial wombs, but, you know, like the other work that we're doing, all the technologies exist. There's no like faster than light travel or, you know, quantum or fusion problem there to solve, right? We have the tools and technologies. It's really about scale and efficiency. So I do think that later generations will be grown fully ex utero. But right now where we are is because this is a systems problem, we have raised a lot of capital so that we can run all of this in parallel and learn from these different species. And so for us, the reason why we started the mammoth and the thylacine at near the same time is to oversimplify the process. You have really bad ancient genomes from the mammoth that you had to assemble. The editing isn't as hard as one might think, but then you have a 22-month gestation. You have exactly opposite the problem with the thylacine or Tasmanian tiger. You've got incredible preserved genomes that allowed us to get to nearly complete genome, and it's that you don't even need for some of the work that we're doing. You then have 70 million years of genetic divergence between a marsupial mouse called a fat-tailed tunnart, which is the closest living relative, but, you know, it's 1,500 times smaller. Mm. And then you have a 13 and a half day gestation where your gestation size is the size of a grain of rice. So it's kind of like easy, or on the mammoth, it's hard, easy, hard. And easy is a vastly oversimplification. And then it's easy, hard, easy in the thylacine. And we felt like those two projects together really allowed us to think about what's working for thylacine and marsupials and what can work for elephants in parallel. And so that's kind of just an overview of the process. But where we are, to your question, is we are in the editing phase on both thylacine and in mammoth. And we can talk about birds later. But on the mammoth and the thylacine, we've immortalized the cells. We've created what's called induced pluripotent stem cells so that we're now working on different types of differentiation so that we can go test our different hypotheses in the lab versus having to even use other lab models or animal models like mice, because some of the evolutionary distance, for example, between elephants and mice being 100 plus million years, it doesn't necessarily help that we can't test the exact edit. We can test similar edits, but we can't test the exact edit in a mice because it's not compatible with life for the mice. And so we've created stem cells, which is incredibly hard. We've done a vast majority of the ancient DNA assembly and the comparative genomics work. So we have our targets and we've created immortalized lines, and now we're actually editing. And the thylacine we recently announced, we've been able to stack over 300 edits all around what we call the thylacine wolf accelerated regions, which are the TORs, or the cranial facial work that's very similar to that of a wolf in the thylacine. And we've actually been able to stack 300 edits, which has never been done in a marsupial, let alone a multicellular species to date. So it's pretty exciting, given that these are nonlinear repeats, meaning that these are individual thylacine-specific edits that we are making in the fat-tailed Dunart. And we're now in the, I think we're at 24, 25 in elephant.
So again, we're not talking about Jurassic Park here. The goal is to introduce these species back into the wild. I'm wondering how is that a plausible goal, and who would have to give you permission to do such a thing, and what are the ethical and environmental concerns that people raise around that act?
Yeah, these are all fantastic questions. What I didn't realize, coming from technology, right, is the rewilding and the successful reintroduction of the species is just as much work as the science, which sounds crazy, right? When you think about it, because we are arguably one of the most cutting edge synthetic biology companies out there attempting something that's never been done before in non-model species. And so while that's incredibly hard, the work to successfully rewild a thylacine, for example, includes, you know, indigenous people groups, private landowners, the governments, the public at large and how they feel about it, ecologists, other conservation groups. And so what we found early on, and once again, this is, I would say, probably one of the things I want to credit Klaus with, probably one of the things I'm most proud of what we've achieved so far, isn't even on the science. It's the fact that we've gotten lots of praise, but we've also gotten lots of criticism. And we have a tendency to try to run towards critics, not away from them, right? You know, I'm sure you deal with this with your podcast, and, you know, especially in the crazy political landscapes that we're in every day these days.
I've never received any criticism that I'm aware of, so I don't know what you're talking about.
Exactly. Yeah. Neither has Colossal. It's so weird that we share that. Mm. But what's interesting is that we take this attitude of trying to run towards informed critics, right? Like, you're always going to have the Twitter or X folks on the sidelines, right, that are not informed critics, that are just don't like you for the reason of the day. But the informed critics, you can learn a lot from. And I was on a podcast early on, and I forgot which one it was, but the gentleman said to me, but have you been to Alaska? Do you know they want mammoths there? How do you know the tribes feel about that? And he was 1,000% right. And I was like, okay, well, I need to go book a trip to Alaska. Who do I know in Alaska? How can we go start having these conversations? And then we followed that same model for the thylacine and now the dodo. And so we now build working groups in every country ahead of time that we're working in. And so we have a Tasmanian Tiger Advisory Board Council that's made up of representation from indigenous people groups, the private landowners, even the logging commission. And you may think that's strange for, you know, wanting to reintroduce species, but the logging commission in the logging industry in Tasmania is the largest economic driver, even ahead of farming. And so it's naive to think that you're going to go into and work on species and work in forestry there without engaging with the, you know, the largest industry that also is the most has the most lobbyists and the most politically charged, right? And so we've taken this very inclusive perspective, and then we've just listened to them. And outside of the ecological reasonings that we can get into, that we have to then go do these ecological studies and surveys on every species, there are these additional layers, like indigenous layers and spiritual layers, right? And so for example, the thylacine is actually part of the creation story to the Aboriginal people. And, you know, just because I don't believe that, that doesn't mean that's not sacred to them. So we need to actually understand what the return of this species means back to their people, because it is their land, you know, their initial indigenous land. And so there's all these interesting kind of soft facets to the work that we're doing that, you know, on day one, I just thought the lab work was hard, and that we had to work, you know, with the right animal rights groups, and we had to work with the right, ensure that we were doing everything humane and transparent for science sake. I really underestimated the amount of time that we would need to spend in country working with all these different special interest groups.
With the thylacine, would you be hoping to reintroduce that just to Tasmania, or would you be doing it for the mainland of Australia and I guess was it New Guinea as well?
That's correct. And there's about 10,000 years of genetic divergence between the mainland Australia and the thylacines of Tasmania, and a little bit further than that on the Papua New Guinea. And some people still believe in some of these species that they still exist, even in Papua New Guinea, but we've seen no evidence to support that, and even supported field research in those countries. And so our goal would start with Tasmania, right? It's such a cultural icon there. The actual environment under which it lived is still there. There's a hope and excitement about it. When we actually launched the project, there was like a 22% ABC News study that's like the people that wanted it back. Through transparency, through education, we just launched an educational series in Tasmania that's free to everyone. And the most recent polling was like north of 70%. And I think in today's world, if you do anything that's north of 50%, you're doing something pseudo right. And so I think we're focusing initially on Tasmania. You know, there's not been a reintroduction of an invasive species or a native species that has replaced the thylacine in its being the apex predator that it was. And you have seen a lot of these mezzanine level marsupials that have developed overpopulation or disease states, like the facial tumor disease in the Tasmanian devil. And so there's a lot of interest in the reintroduction of the thylacine specifically for those ecological reasons.
Are you telling me we think thylacines eat Tasmanian devils?
Yeah, so there was a rumor back in the 1930s that the thylacines ate sheep, and that's why the bounties were put on them by the Australian government to kill them. But it was really most likely sheep herders killing each other's sheep and stealing from each other than thylacines. There's no data that shows that thylacines ever tackled those types of animals or ate in those types of packs, right? And so most likely, from what we understand, quolls, and which is another carnivorous marsupial, and wombats and Tasmanian devils were the primary prey of thylacines.
Hmm. Wow, it's hard to imagine anything eating a Tasmanian devil.
And Tasmanian devils get a bad rap, but they are amazing animals. I was fortunate enough to rewild Ned, who is the 21st Tasmanian devil without that terrible facial tumor disease, which is a transmissible cancer. Talk about terrifying. Mm. And I was able to rewild Ned back into the mainland Australia a year ago when I was there. And I'll tell you, the species has an interesting name due to its eating behaviors and the terrible sounds it makes, specifically when it's eating or mating. Mm. But they are actually really adorable, amazing animals when you actually spend time with them.
Nice. What am I confusing a Tasmanian devil with then? There's something,
No, people have this view that Tasmanian devils are, because they've seen everything from cartoons to stories, but they actually, and they do make the most evil sounds you've ever heard. If I heard a Tasmanian devil eating in, or a pack of them eating on a carcass at night, you'd think you're hearing something, you know, from another realm. It sounds terrifying. So they do get a pretty bad rep.
I think the neurons that represent Tasmanian devil in my brain also represent wolverines.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think must be bigger and objectively more dangerous. Yeah.
Yeah, that wolverines are bigger and but I mean, rough body plan similar.
Yeah. Okay, so back to the rewilding of these species. So what's the plan for rewilding the mammoth? Where would you put them and who wants them? And what's the possible downside of either species suddenly living once again on Earth now in a more crowded Earth with people on it?
Yeah, so you have to spend a lot of time in these different groups and these ecological studies and looking at them. We have been talking and spending a lot of time in Alaska with various indigenous groups, with the former lieutenant governor, with the head of Fish and Wildlife there, who's actually on our conservation advisory board. So we try to keep them updated in a very similar fashion to what we're doing in Mauritius, where the dodo went extinct, and in Tasmania. But what's interesting is mammals and non-mammals, and especially birds, they don't see geopolitical boundaries. So in a perfect world, absent the geopolitical nature that we live in today, and it was just a Garden of Eden-like planet, as those myths once talked about, you would actually have, you know, you'd have mammoths all over what's called Mammoth Steppe. So if you look at Alaska, northern Canada, and northern Europe, and all over northern Russia and China, that would be optimal for mammoths. Like Siberia is a great location. Mammoths were able to survive in negative, you know, all the way from today's temperatures all the way down to, you know, negative 40. You know, they were incredibly important to that, the biodiversity of that ecosystem. They actually increased the nitrogen oxygen cycling through defecation and through trampling the snow and actually uprooting trees that were not carbon efficient, as we see with forest elephants in Africa. And so given the geopolitical nature that we all exist in, you know, we've started with northern United States as well as Alaska in having those conversations. But we also have to factor in things like not just human population density areas, but also things like caribou migratory patterns in other species that are also protected, right? They've started to reintroduce wood bison back into Alaska. And so how does all of that, how does that ecology all work together? And, you know, I think we've been very, very fortunate that these projects aren't happening overnight, right? Like, I don't have 1,000 mammoths today without a place to put them. So we can be thoughtful about the planning of these reintroduction species and, you know, equally important to the planning, be very collaborative in that process. And, but I think our first mammoths will probably be rewilded back in Alaska or some of the northern United States.
So what's the optimistic time frame? What's the rational and truly defensible time frame, or can you not give a time frame at this point?
No, so we set a goal for our mammoths, for our first mammoth calves to be born by late 2028. We feel confident in that. Do I think that's aggressive? Yes. I mean, we're talking about some of the most cutting edge science, and you're talking about a 22-month gestation. That means by the end of 2026, beginning of 2027, we have to have viable embryos. Now, given the, you know, we have 40 plus people on the mammoth team, you know, we have an entire embryology lab that I didn't even mention earlier. We're working elephants right now. We're working elephant husbandry right now, trying to eradicate elephant disease, trying to do elephant assisted reproductive technologies to help elephants reproduce more. Given that we're parallel pathing it, we do feel confident in that timeline. I do think that, you know, with a 30-day gestation on the dodo and a 13.5-day gestation on the thylacine, I think it's possible that the mammoth could, you know, not be the first species. You know, we set out a date of 8 to 10 years for our first thylacines, a little under two years in, and we're ahead of schedule. And so I think that it is possible we could see a species before the mammoth. But we feel that, you know, if we miss the dates on the mammoth, you know, it's not like a 2040 timeline. You know, it'd probably be a year or two, maybe 6 months. So I think that we feel very confident about the 2028 timeline. But I think we feel extremely confident about in this decade, right? And so these aren't, you know, like Mars missions and other things that require so many different levels of approval in different like launch windows that we say 2028 and it's 2050. I think we're in this decade for numerous species, including mammoth.
And what's the state of artificial womb technology? I mean, you say that ultimately you think that's the vehicle to bring this to scale. Where is that now, and what are people doing with it?
Yeah, so we have a 17-person team working on artificial wombs. You know, Colossal is not focused on human healthcare, even though our app, we try not to cross those streams, to use other sci-fi Ghostbuster terms. We definitely don't want people to think, oh, they're working on mammoths and making superhumans, right? So we want to make sure that we stay true to just focusing on de-extinction and species preservation. But many of these technologies do have applications to human healthcare, that which we may license out or spin out. You know, obviously that has its own ethical, and you're going to have religious, you're going to have a lot of people that have a perspective on that, right? And so for us, we have a 17-person team. We've broken the project down into kind of three categories: non-placental mammals. You know, that's, the marsupials are technically placental mammals, but the placenta kind of only has a cameo at the last stage of gestation. So it's not critical for nutrient and excrement and oxygen exchange. It's kind of just this weird thin layer that hasn't evolved out of it yet. And then you have placental mammals like us and mice and rats and ferrets and cats and mammoths. And then you've got birds. And so we have a synthetic egg project that allows to grow different sized birds and productionize birds without having to use surrogates in birds. We have a non-placental mammal project for marsupials that's a roller culture type system that can get us to gestation, we believe. And then we have a placental mammal project where we're having to build out a placental interface. So we not only, what's beautiful for us from a biology perspective is that the placenta invades the uterine wall and gets all of the things it needs, you know, from its host mother, right? So that's great because we didn't have to invent the placenta. I don't know how we'd ever try to tackle that. So you have this like invasive thing that comes out of, that hatches out of the embryo and invades into the placental wall and does the vast majority of the work. And so we just have to, I'm oversimplifying it. We've got to create the right conditions. We have to do all the right chemical cueing. We got to have the right synthetic uterine wall that it wants to invade into and can stick, and also can stick and scale to that of, you know, hundreds of pounds and in a elephant fetus. And then we've got to deliver all the right nutrient, excrement, and gas exchange at every single stage of development. And so we've broken the project down into these three projects, and then we've broken it down into early gestation, mid gestation, and late term on each of them. And, you know, while we don't have anything that we've grown ex utero, I believe by 2026, we'll have grown a mammal fully ex utero based on current course and speed. You know, it'll be a small mammal with a short gestation. It will not be a, blue whale or an elephant. But, that's where you start. And there's about 9 different placental types. So you just have to keep iterating on the system to allow for that.
So now how does this become a profitable business? Where's the business case for reintroducing these species, or are they just, are you talking about the business use of ancillary technologies of a sort that we've just been talking about with like artificial wombs or applications to human health and, you know, cancer biology or anything else that might spin off of this?
Yeah. So the first is our primary business objective that you said, right? So we've spun off 2 technology companies. We have 2 more that are in process. We'll probably spin out one in 2025, one in 2026. Just our genome engineering technologies, we think are worth tens of billions of dollars, right? Like no one has come close to what we've been able to achieve. And the feedback that we've gotten from some of our other healthcare investors, InQtel, which, you know, sees a lot of deals, obviously, and many of our other partners. So the technology side of it is a fundamental driver of economic returns for us, number one. Number two, there is an educational component to this, right? And so what's fascinating is with no animals, with nothing, just the aware of talking about conservation, talking about de-extinction, showing the application of these technologies, kids and parents and governments are excited about it. They're now saying, you know, could you build curriculum for us and whatnot? So we do think there's an educational component that we didn't originally think of. A third is the rewilding. So if you look at, you had carbon credits, you still have them, which has kind of had ups and downs. Like I think carbon and biodiversity credits may be the only true good application of things like crypto, but that's another conversation. and blockchain. And so, but you do have a real way to measure constants of carbon and carbon improvement. And I think that you're now seeing the rise of biodiversity credits. I think over time, those mature. And, I don't think certain organizations ever can truly become carbon negative with their business models. So I think that that model, which is shown to be a $200 billion market that's forecasted to grow to $2.7 trillion due to the Paris Agreement and a few other agreements that have come out of COP and some of these others, organizations or conferences, I think that's a blossoming market that eventually evolves into nature credits. I think people focused on carbon. Now there's some focus on methane. Now there's some focus on biodiversity. Now there's focusing on ecosystem restoration. I think eventually it evolves into just a standardized nature credit. And if you look at some of these pledges, you know, 66% of the folks that signed the Paris Agreement agree that the vast majority of their work needs to be nature-based, not like direct air carbon capture and whatnot. They need nature-based solutions to this. We know rewilding works. We can measure it. We've seen the success of it in numerous applications here in the US and in Europe and other locations and in England. And so for us, I think that there is these animals, you know, almost can represent an annuity. So when you think about like things like content capture, ecotourism of animals back in country, and then the biodiversity and carbon aspects of the business, I mean, you're talking about long-term annuities that shows that there's a much more valuable way to keep the animals and have them thrive in their natural environments than to hunt them or sell their data to poachers, right? As we're seeing, we're starting to see that transition in Gabon, where people used to just go sell data about the forest elephants to poachers so that they could make money for their village, right? Now they're saying, oh, wow, there's actually a value in these animals in protecting them and keeping them alive. So that's another early idea that we've had. And some of the modeling on it is, you know, billions of dollars of annuities. So we think that some matrix of that combination, as well as helping governments with their biodiversity crisis, could be very interesting. We're negotiating several, you know, nine-figure contracts right now with governments that have biodiversity crises. And even though we offered the technology for free, it's kind of like open source, right? You can go use the technology for free, but sometimes it's better just to go hire the people that made the open source technology, right? So yeah, we're seeing multiple, and that's just what we know today. I think that in the next 5 years, we'll know a lot more, and there'll probably be even newer ways to monetize.
Well, Ben, it's totally fascinating work, and better yet, it's a lot of fun. So needless to say, you have an open door to come back once you have any one of these species actually walking around. I would love to talk to you about it, and maybe we'll do that one in video so we can actually see what you have produced.
Yeah, and if you ever want to do a lab tour, just let us know. We'd love to have you.
Yes.
Yeah,
so where are you based? You're in Dallas?
We have two labs in Dallas, one in Melbourne, Australia, and one in Boston. Mm-hmm. But our main lab is in Dallas.
Nice. Well, to be continued, Ben. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much.